This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. America went to the polls a week ago today. 7 days later, all major networks and the AP have called the race for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. Donald Trump is not conceding, and the administration is blocking the start of the transition process. Here's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell on the floor of the Senate yesterday.
Our institutions are actually built for this. We have the system in place to consider concerns. And President Trump is 100% within his rights to look into allegations of irregularities and weigh his legal options.
And here's Minority Leader Senator Chuck Schumer.
Make no mistake, there has been no evidence of any significant widespread voter fraud. Joe Biden won this election fair and square. The margins of his victory are growing by the day.
Now, the ongoing dispute, coupled with an unsettled balance of power in the U.S. Senate and Democratic losses in the House, paint a challenging picture for the country and for the Massachusetts congressional delegation. For more, we welcome WBUR's Callum Borchers. Callum, welcome back.
Good to be back, Tiziana. Although, has it really been only a week? Oh, my goodness.
It's been a year of a week, Callum. No question.
It certainly has.
So I'm going to start by asking you, is Joe Biden the president-elect when the results aren't final and thus not official? And this is not a political question. This is kind of a procedural question, Callum.
Sure. I feel like a high school civics teacher, but let's talk about the process since we're asking. So, you know, Massachusetts right here, which was a blowout, right? Biden won by 30 plus points, but we're still accepting overseas ballots until Friday. Also, keep in mind that there's a routine audit going on of 3%, I should say, of all of the precincts. And the municipal clerks here in this state aren't going to certify their results to the Secretary of State until next Wednesday. So even technically, Massachusetts isn't over in the strictest sense. More broadly, the Electoral College doesn't vote until December 14th, and Congress won't count and certify that result until January 6th. So, I mean, strictly speaking, that's when Biden will officially be president-elect. But, I mean, for all practical purposes, he is the president-elect today.
And sticking with practical purposes, isn't it typical for the transition to begin as soon as the election is called, whether that's on Election Day or after Election Day? You know, compare this to past elections.
Well, that's right. It is typical. And so usually the General Services Administration provides money and office space for a transition team as soon as the election is called. As you noted at the top, the GSA is refusing to do that for now. Something like this did happen in 2000, of course, when we had that very tight recount going on in Florida, and the GSA didn't release funds until Gore conceded in mid-December of that year. That was shortly before the Electoral College actually held their vote. President Clinton at the time had actually suggested funding two transition teams at once, which didn't happen, but I think it suggests how important this transition phase is. I mean, keep in mind, too, that Joe Biden has been receiving classified intelligence briefings since September. It's customary for the major party nominees to get those briefings even before somebody is elected, because it is so important to have this smooth transition of power. And even more recently, you know, President Trump was making his cabinet selections before the Electoral College voted in 2016. So it's not as if what's going on right now is historically premature.
Okay, so as Mitch McConnell said, the Trump campaign is within its rights to bring legal challenges. But even the president's own lawyers seem to be saying these are really long shots. The New York Times is reporting that attorneys at Jones Day, which is a firm representing the president in these suits, are concerned that they're participating in legal maneuvers that actually lack evidence and could undermine the integrity of the election. So is this a legal strategy or a political strategy? What's going on here?
Some of both. I mean, the legal strategy focuses on trying to disqualify ballots that have arrived after Election Day. And Pennsylvania is probably the biggest battleground because they had this 3-day grace period, right, for ballots that were postmarked by Election Day but didn't arrive until 3 days afterward. Now, in the meantime, the Supreme Court has ordered Pennsylvania to keep these late arriving ballots separate just in case the grace period is overturned. Now, that's probably unlikely. And it's also worth remembering that Biden leads by about 48,000 votes in Pennsylvania. Compare that to just several hundred during the Florida recount in 2000. So it's unlikely that Pennsylvania could change. And also, even if Pennsylvania were to change, it wouldn't change the overall outcome of the presidential race. So as you suggested, there's a political component to this too. And it could be about, from a Republican perspective, building a case for additional election security laws. And Democrats, of course, would probably view those efforts as an attempt at voter suppression.
Okay, so let's come home to Massachusetts. There are a lot of Democratic players in the Bay State who might be waiting in the wings to join a Biden-Harris administration when things are finalized. Former Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, he was just named head of Biden's coronavirus task force. You've got Secretary John Kerry, Congressman Joe Kennedy, maybe even Senator Elizabeth Warren. Are you hearing more about the role that Massachusetts leaders and elected former elected officials might play in forming a Biden administration?
Well, as the Boston mayor, Marty Walsh, said over the weekend, he can't take everyone from Massachusetts. So that is an impressive roster you just ticked off. Marty Walsh himself, by the way, has notably not said that he is seeking a third term officially, as he's facing challenges from Michelle Wu and Andrea Campbell. So it's possible that Marty Walsh could even be in the running for some type of position. John Kerry, you mentioned he campaigned hard for Joe Biden. He could be a candidate for either his old job or some other one. He was confirmed by the Senate in a 94-3 vote in 2013, so he might be somebody who could actually get through relatively easily. Joe Kennedy does make some sense because he's not going back to Congress and he's kind of a free agent when his term is up. Warren's appointment would be a little bit more complicated, though.
Yeah, let's talk about that. What is the thought? I mean, with there being a Republican governor who would be in a position to appoint, at least in the short term, her replacement to the Senate.
Well, I think the uncertainty in Georgia could hurt her chances. So keep in mind, we've got these probably two Senate runoffs on January 5th in Georgia. And so we won't know who controls the Senate until then. And Biden may want to make his cabinet picks earlier than that. So let's just suppose in the Democrats' dream scenario, they pull off upsets in Georgia and win both of those seats. So that would make the Senate 50-50 if we count independents who caucus with the Democrats. So then the Vice President Kamala Harris would cast tie-breaking votes. They would effectively control the Senate. But imagine in that scenario if they then appointed Elizabeth Warren to a cabinet post and allowed Charlie Baker to fill her seat with a Republican who would temporarily hand control back to the GOP after they had fought so hard to control the Senate. That would be temporary until a special election, of course, but I'm sure the Democrats would be loath to do that.
Okay, so last question for you, Callum. The Commonwealth returned its entire delegation except newly elected Jake Auchincloss from the 4th. Everyone's a Democrat. Yesterday, Congresswoman Catherine Clark told us here on the show that the Democratic agenda in Washington not going to change much in the new year, but good chance that the Democrats have a slimmer lead in the House and will not be in control of the Senate. So what does that mean for the agenda that leaders here in Massachusetts envision?
Well, it's a good question. And I thought it was interesting over the weekend in Joe Biden's address to the nation that when he talked about a mandate, of course, candidates often talk about they've won a mandate in election. He said that the mandate is for the parties to cooperate with each other, which I thought was interesting. As Catherine Clark said, the Democrats' legislative goals may remain largely the same. I do think the agenda, though, could change in the sense that the House will probably do less oversight and investigation of a Biden administration than they did of the Trump administration. Now, we heard them say many times in recent years, we can walk and chew gum at the same time, right? Like we can still legislate and investigate, but there is a finite amount of time in the day. And so with less investigation, they may have more time to push that legislative agenda forward.
All right. That is WBUR's Callum Borchers. Cal, thanks.
Glad to be with you.
The T is in trouble. Ridership is down as much as 70%, and the MBTA faces a $300 million deficit. So now General Manager Steve Poftak is proposing deep cuts to service, including, among other measures, the elimination of all ferry service and some bus routes, no commuter rail service on the weekends, and trains running less frequently on the subway system. These changes, they could have significant implications for the Commonwealth's workforce. Call us. Are you relying on the T to get to work now? Did you before the pandemic and you're not now? If you're not riding it now, will you go back to the T at some point? Are you worried about fewer transit options, more cars will wind up on the road as we recover from the pandemic? I mean, there are questions. We want to know what you're thinking on the environment, on the economy. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or send us a tweet at Radio Boston. We've got a good group to help us talk about this. Jim Aloisi is the former Massachusetts Secretary of Transportation and board member of the group Transit Matters. And Jared Johnson is the Chief Operating Officer of Transit Matters. Jim and Jared, good to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having us.
And I do want to note, we did invite Steve Poftak, the general manager of the MBTA, on the show today and yesterday, but he was unavailable. Jared, I'm just going to start with you and ask you straight up, do you think these cuts are the right call?
No, I think these cuts are, first of all, happening far too early. You know, the situation is really dynamic. And then also, I don't think that the T is taking into account the totality of these cuts. You know, before they've said that these cuts are permanent and that they will take a long time to recover from. And we've seen them pull back on that language. And, you know, quite frankly, I just don't buy it. Now, these cuts.
What do you mean pull back on that language?
They, you know, yesterday the general manager said these cuts are not permanent and they spent some time talking about building back. But, you know, they were right the first time. You know, you don't turn on service like a tap. It's not just, oh, you know, we've got some few more people riding the train today. Now let's get some more operators. You know, these operators, it takes months, sometimes over a year, to train these bus operators, these motor personnel, and these engineers for the commuter rail train. So this is not something that we're going to just recover from. And it's going to have really, you know, chilling impacts on a number of other sectors of our society as well. So, you know, I really want to stress that these cuts, you know, could have real permanent impacts.
Jim, I'm going to play some sound here for you from Steve Poftek, and the question on my mind is about whether there was another option. He said yesterday that it's not fiscally responsible to operate a system with empty trains and buses. Here he is.
Any savings achieved now in fiscal year 2021 will help address the projected gap in fiscal year 2022. Therefore, the MBTA needs to continue to take proactive measures now to close the projected gap that is rapidly approaching.
He also, though, Jim, pointed out, you know, massive differentials in pre-pandemic ridership and current ridership, and the fact that service has stayed at pre-pandemic levels. It does seem like from a revenue standpoint, that's a math problem that doesn't work. So were there other options, or was the T stuck between sort of a figurative rock and hard place here?
Well, there's plenty of other options, and the T's in a rock and a hard place of its own making. Let's talk about facts. The facts are that the federal government came to the rescue, and the T doesn't have an operating budget problem this year, this fiscal year. That means through June of next year, right, that problem was solved. So they're anticipating a problem after June 30th, 2021. And they're anticipating a problem because they're anticipating riders won't come back. And I guess they're anticipating that President-elect Biden won't enact into law an additional relief package.
Okay, so and let me just stop you there for a second, Jim. Just to make it clear for listeners, I think what you're saying is that there was a federal relief package that applied to the current fiscal year, and that's a good deal of how the problem got solved. And you're saying they're assuming there won't be a second one in subsequent fiscal years. Is that right?
Yes, they're assuming that, and without evidence. The evidence now that we know that we have a new president coming into office is that there probably will be a relief bill. But let's also say they're also assuming ridership will remain low. Now, of course, ridership will remain low if the T decides to cut service. This is a prediction of their own making. Of course, ridership will be low if the T makes it confusing to people about when the next bus is coming or when the next train is coming, which is exactly what they're doing. So when the T says, well, we're anticipating a deep budget problem after June 30th next year, it's of their own making. Look, the governor runs the T, right? I mean, Steve Poftek runs the T day to day, but the governor controls it. The governor can move and act tomorrow to raise net new revenue for the T if he wanted to. Why doesn't he? So could the legislature,
join this.
But there's no leadership happening at that level, right? And that is part of the problem. That's part of the problem.
Join this conversation, 1-800-423-8255. Are you riding the T? Are you not? How do you feel about these service cuts? We've got Mary on the line from Braintree. Mary, go ahead.
Hi, I want to know what the T has done to cut costs before cutting service. Top management pay cuts, get rid of the consultants, and how about no retirement at age 50? Make it 62, 65 like the rest of us. I want to hear that first.
All right, Mary, let's turn to Jared. Jared, what do you know?
Yeah, I know they have identified cost savings. They've tasked their team with identifying cost savings, and our understanding is that they have actually found a lot of cost savings. On the executive side, that's a little bit tougher. Because you know you actually do need to have top quality folks there to run a huge agency. But I think the bigger point here is that these service cuts are not actually going to save that much money. We're talking about service cuts on the order of 25-35%, and we're talking about savings on the order of 8 or 10%. So this is not a fiscally prudent a strategy. It's just it's not going to result in that much of an impact on the budget, but it's going to have a huge impact on the budget of low income riders. And like I said, it's you know, like what Jim said, it's a self fulfilling prophecy. You know, it's what we in the industry call a death spiral. You know, you cut service so people don't come back, and then people don't come back, so then you have a justification to continue cutting service, and so on and so forth. And we've seen that this is how Washington D.C.'s system went from a model and something everyone looked at to now a system that is still struggling to dig itself out of a hole from the mid 2000s.
Jim Aloisi and Jared Johnson, stand by. And listeners, we'll continue to take your calls at 800-423-8255. I want to take a minute to bring in another voice here. Mella Miles is the Director of Transit-Oriented Development and the T-Riders Union at Alternatives for Community and Environment. Welcome back to the show, Mella.
Thank you for having me. Good afternoon.
So Mella, bus routes are shortened. Some are consolidated. Some will be eliminated. Who gets affected by cuts to bus service?
The people who are affected are those who have no other option but to ride on a bus. I always say, no one's on a bus just because they want to be on a bus in the middle of a pandemic. They're not out for a field trip. This is a lifeline to get to work, to go to their doctor's appointment, school, wherever else they need to get to. And the other folks, the people who are also on there may be undocumented. There are frontline workers. There are cleaners, those people who are cleaning up after us and trying to keep us safe from pathogens that could infect us and do far worse.
So, Mella, MBTA officials have said they took a data-driven approach. They tried to determine where to cut service based on keeping up service in areas with heavier use, operating as much as they can with things like bus routes in lower-income areas and communities of color. Are you satisfied with what they've said about their decision-making process? And do you think these proposals are done sufficiently with equity in mind?
I'm not satisfied, and I don't think they're necessarily done with equity in mind. Prioritizing the critical riders, as they keep saying, is something that they have lifted up. But at the end of the day, we're seeing that some of the bus routes that they are chopping up or cutting off, or even, for example, the Fairmont line right now, the commuter rail service, which is not on the chopping block, they're planning to cut the service off for the weekend starting in January of 2021. We also see buses that were on their bus network redesign and a better bus project for redesign being cut out, like the 18 bus, the 34E bus. And then going into the ride situation where when they change the service area, then people who are not within the service area for the ride then become premium ride users and have to pay a higher price. It might go from $2 up to $5 per ride, and that makes people who have to depend upon the ride not be able to get to where they're going, which, you know, a lot of folks who are have different abilities, they may be not mobile to be able to walk, or they might say, like, they cut out the bus route of the 18 and they say you can walk to a train station. It's within a quarter of a mile. That's assuming that the person can walk. Those are the ones who are being highly affected.
Well, Mella Miles, I appreciate you bringing that perspective into the conversation today for our listeners. Mella Miles is the Director of Transit-Oriented Development and the T-Riders Union at Alternatives for Community and Environment. Thanks.
Thank you.
Let's grab a couple calls here and turn back to Jim and Jared. 800-423-8255. We have Tony on the line from East Boston. Tony, go ahead.
Hi. One of the holes that they buried the overruns on the Big Dig, one of the holes they used were bond issues by the MBTA. Why does the MBTA have to take on debt to subsidize people coming down from New Hampshire? Why not put tolls on 93 and have that subsidize public transit, which is more environmentally friendly and economically will develop the area?
Tony, thanks for that suggestion. Let's add George as well. George and Dedham, go ahead.
I used to take the T every day. Now I can't because working from remote. I just got to say, I know the T's in the corner like everybody else, and I just don't understand when people say raise revenue. That essentially means raises taxes on people during COVID and the pandemic. Just doesn't seem like a good idea either. So, you know, it's just more uncertainty from Congress that is causing this problem. And just like Jim and the other guests, I hope that the Biden administration will be able to put a deal together.
George, thanks for that. So, Jim, back to the revenue picture. You know, bonds,
sure.
Bad idea to raise taxes during COVID. So what are practical next steps that can actually happen? Or are these cuts essentially inevitable next month when the board votes?
Well, they shouldn't be inevitable. Let me illuminate a couple of things. First of all, Tony from East Boston, my hometown, he's right about bonding. Here's the dirty little secret that is in the T documents. They're proposing to bond an additional $3 billion with the B dollars without any revenue to support it in order to maintain the facade of their capital program. That's in their own documents, number one. Number two, net new revenue is critical for the recovery of a sustainable transit system. If you're driving today and traffic congestion is rising every single day in metro greater Boston, if you're driving, you're probably working. So this idea that you can't raise revenue because it's a pandemic doesn't hold water when you realize that the revenue would be raised from people fairly, the ones who continue to work and continue to have revenue. So the governor's own plan to put a carbon tax on fuel called the Transit Climate Initiative, he should move on that. But as I said earlier, there's no willingness to move on it. Now, let me just say one other thing. Chicago isn't cutting service. The Chicago Transit Authority is not cutting any service. What makes Chicago different from Boston? I hear that the pandemic is in Chicago as well. I hear that the conditions are the same there as well. So we have to really wonder why it is that from an ideological point of view, the T decides that the path of least resistance is not to do the hard government work of raising revenue, but go back to a program of retrenchment that will only, as Jared said, create a circular environment where it's a pathway downward, not a pathway upward.
Jared, I want to turn to you, but I'm going to grab a call here first. 800-423-8255. We've got Amanda on the line from Waltham. Amanda, go ahead.
Hi. I was calling in regards to the ferries that are in Hingham and Hull. I think it's terrible that they're going to get cut. They're a critical part of the economy because many people that are in the trades take them into the city to help build places like the seaport. I grew up in a union family that people were commuting that way. It was environmentally friendly. And also many people moved to the area specifically for that. So I think that even though people say, well, you can still take the commuter rail, that a lot of the commuter rail is being cut. And also the ferries go towards the Harbor Islands, which are a critical part of Boston's identity. And as far as even thinking about tourism as well, that people need to remember that aspect could be played up post-pandemic. So it would be a real
Amanda,
tragedy if they were.
Thank you. I'm going to double check on the ferries to the Harbor Islands. But let me, while we have someone do that, Jared, let me come back to you. I mean, larger questions about the economy, people's ability to be able to participate in the economy. I'm going to play a little sound to add to that for you. This is Steve Tolman, the president of the Massachusetts AFL-CIO, who spoke during the public comment section during the Zoom board, the Zoom call for the control board yesterday. Here he is.
Public transportation opens doors to economic opportunity. And the only way countless of people in Massachusetts have to get to school or work, it's important. Cutting service will deepen the longstanding inequities and stifle our recovery by blocking access to jobs for people who cannot get to work without our transit system.
So what about that, Jared?
Well, I think that Secretary Pollack and some of the folks at the MBTA, it seems that they know the cost of everything, but the value of nothing. And you know, from my perspective, you know, he's absolutely right. You know, the T is about connecting people to jobs, to healthcare. You know, one of the things that was really striking was, you know, I know that they're saying, you know, we're trying to prioritize, you know, this service and only X number of people are riding the train late at night. You know, we shouldn't confuse relatively low ridership with low importance. You know, there may only be a relatively small amount of folks riding some of the trains late at night or riding the trains in the evening. But these are the same folks that 6 months ago we were clapping for. We were calling them heroes. They don't want applause, and they don't want claps. What they want is some of the things that are beyond, you know, the control of this conversation, you know, good health care and good wages. But at the very least, they want to be able to get to work and to not have to, you know, either pay out half of their day's income in Uber or Lyft or inconvenience family and friends. I mean, you know, another thing, just like the caller was talking about folks moving, you know, specifically to some towns on the South Shore in order to use the ferry. It's the same thing all across the region. You know, the governor's own administration has really pushed transit-oriented development as a strategy to help, you know, get us out of the housing crisis. And now we're going to be sending the exact opposite incentive to cities and towns. We're going to be taking away the commuter rail service that these cities and towns are pitching, you know, to developers and are you know, using to sort of push back on concerns about traffic and overpopulation in their cities and towns. So this is absolutely an incredibly short-sighted decision on these cuts that are going to have permanent, long-lasting impacts.
So I'm going to go back to the phones here, and as I do, in response to Amanda, who called in a few minutes ago, the ferry lines to the Harbor Islands are not a part of these cuts, Amanda. We've got Dennis on the line from East Boston. Dennis, go ahead.
Hello. Thanks for the show. In talking about the debt load and so on, and the amount of money that has to be raised through whatever kind of funding or revenue, my question is about the pension component of the budget. My understanding, and I think it's been reported previously in the press, that a T employee's pension is based on their final year of service. And I'm just wondering if we could get some clarity about that, and also to sort of dimension of how much of the budget is to fund pensions.
It's a good question, Dennis. Jim, can you help us with that?
I'm not going to be able to give you an exact number on the budget cost of pensions. It's significant, but in the course of things, it's trivial. The pensions have become another one of these sort of ideological talking points that is, if we completely, you know, solve the pension problem tomorrow, all of our fiscal woes will go away. It's just not true. We need to focus on the reality that the T doesn't have enough money in its capital budget, and it's going to bond $3 billion without any resources to support it. We need to focus on the reality that the T's cutting service when Chicago isn't, because the T's not willing to raise net new revenue that it needs to sustain itself. It's not about pensions.
What is it? Massachusetts billionaires have earned $17 billion over the course of this coronavirus pandemic. That's a failure. That's a policy failure.
So what are you suggesting, Jared?
We need to have progressive taxation. You know, and I think, you know, I think it is a yes and thing. I think it is both, you know, user fees. You know, gas has dropped. You know, it's 50 cents or 60 cents lower, you know, than it was at the beginning of this year. And as, you know, my friend Stacey Thompson likes to point out, people are far more impacted by geopolitical events that are happening in the Middle East and Russia. Those cause far greater fluctuations in the gas prices than a 10, 15, or even a 20 cent taxes is talking about. But absolutely, I think, you know, we need to be we need to be capturing some of that revenue. We need to be asking some of the folks who have some of the wealthiest folks in the Commonwealth to pay their fair share. You know, their economic gains have come because essential workers took the T. And so I think it's only fair to ask them to help pay for this problem and to help fix this budget gap.
All right. So you've both alluded to the longer term budget gap, you know, as well, on top of a $579 million gap for 2022, the Massachusetts Taxpayer Foundation testified to MBTA officials yesterday that by 2025, funding sources for maintenance, safety and modernization will start falling about $1 billion short of what's needed. I am hearing both of you call for increased revenues for different approaches. Are we running the risk of a starvation cycle for the T, given where ridership is and many people predicting it's not going to return to pre-pandemic levels for a long time? I mean, could we essentially see this T starve away? I mean, I know it seems dramatic, but is it?
Well,
I don't think it's that dramatic.
Yeah, I don't think it's dramatic. Look, again, it's within our control, and it's within the T's control. It's within the governor's control correct this problem. If you don't believe in public transportation, then you might not feel so bad if public transportation doesn't return to a kind of vitality and robustness that it should, right? You wouldn't use a blunt instrument like service cuts. You'd be talking more about service redesign and service redeployment. And if you believed in government being an actor, and if you believed in the public transportation as a public good, you'd be trying to shape the future, not collapse in the front of the pandemic. You'd be shaping the future. It's not shaping the future to begin a process of service cuts that double down on more automobility, more auto congestion, less sustainability, less access for people, and frankly, less social cohesion, because if you're going to starve the T so that the only people using it out of necessity, and you've lost the benefits of an egalitarian system, you are going to threaten social cohesion in Metro Boston. So you've got to think about all of these factors if you're put in a position of running something like Metro Boston's public transportation system. You got to be proactive, not reactive. And we're not seeing any of that. And it's a huge disappointment, and it needs to stop. They need to correct course, and we're going to try, as others, to push the issue so that they do correct course.
Yeah,
Jared, last 30 seconds are to you.
Yep, absolutely. I think what's so frustrating is, you know, so what if the governor doesn't, you know, doesn't care about public transit? You know, we're not going to make him, this year, but he cares about housing. He cares about, or at least says he cares about, economic development and racial justice and the environment. The T is related to all of those things. And he, like, as Jim has said time and time again, he has it in his power to use the T for those things. And to your point about the capital dropping off, it's unconscionable to me that the T is spending $1 billion on South Coast Rail without, and now talking about huge service cuts, without a plan on the capital side on how they're going to fix a huge bottleneck that is going to cause the South Coast Rail program to run into a huge issue operationally.
All right. Well, that is Jared Johnson, the Chief Operating Officer of Transit Matters, and Jim Aloisi, former Massachusetts Secretary of Transportation, board member of Transit Matters. Always satisfying to have the two of you on. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
It has already been a busy week in sports, and it's only Tuesday. You could say it's the week when bubbles began to burst. The Patriots clearly no longer the powerhouse they were for 20 years. COVID looks like it may massively disrupt the college football season. And some baseball purists feeling the sting today as the Red Sox officially bring back an admitted cheater, though one beloved by players, as the team's manager. So let's check the score on all of it. We've got Radio Boston's Chris Siderick here. Hey there, Chris.
Hey, Tiziana, and I do have to note before we get started, a lot there to cover, obviously, but within the last hour, we've had breaking news that the Celtics legend Tommy Heinsohn has passed away at the age of 86. Mm. And I struggled a little bit to come up with the words because this is a franchise that has had so many incredibly iconic players, from Bill Russell, Larry Bird, Paul Pierce. There is no one more synonymous with the Boston Celtics than Tommy Heinsohn. And I think his presence has been felt by literally generations of fans. So he was a player for 9 seasons on this team, 8 championships, a Hall of Fame player in his own right. He was a coach for this team for almost a decade. And he's done play-by-play for the Celtics for almost 40 years. He and Mike Gorman are the longest-running sports combo in terms of a broadcast of all time. And I just want to highlight a little bit of that. If you haven't ever watched a Celtics game on TV, Tommy had just such a unique style. He was a homer in the greatest sense of the word. He loved this team. He literally bled green. And I just want to play a little bit of that so you can get a taste of how much passion he felt for the Celtics franchise.
Paul Pierce, who is an upper echelon player in this league, has been treated like a rookie.
He's down at the other end. He's all right.
And walked!
That was...
He walked! What is the matter with these guys? They're going to call it a hard foul. They're going to call it a hard foul? These guys are ridiculous. These guys are ridiculous.
I mean... This is incredibly tragic news, but I'm smiling because he was just so unique and just an incredible broadcaster, an incredible player, an incredible part of this franchise. And I just think there really aren't words to capture what he meant to the city of Boston. He was a legend. You know, one of his teammates, Frank Ramsey, once said as a player, he'd knock his own grandmother down for 2 points. So, I mean, he just lived Boston Celtics basketball, and we lost a real legend today.
Yeah, you know, it made me chuckle to hear that. Sometimes we feel the loss so profoundly because of the way the person brought us joy, right? And clearly he brought the joy of the sport to the Celtics and to Boston.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know if you've heard of Tommy points, but it's the most Boston thing of all time. That if a player would do something like dive into the stands to save a ball, that's a Tommy point! He would get so excited for guys that would hustle and just leave it all on the court. In an effort to win the game. And it just, that kind of passion, as you said, is just truly contagious and wonderful.
Well, Chris, it's sad, but I got to tell you, you telling us about that, starting with that, I don't know, it just warms my heart. Thank you. All right, we do have some sports business to talk about here, starting with the Sox. They reintroduced Alex Cora today. We fired him for cheating while he was with the Astros in 2017. So tell people what's going on.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw, they tweeted out a picture of Alex Cora walking across the bridge with the sequel was the caption. So the team is obviously hyping this move. It's just really interesting to think back. As you said, Cora admitted his own role in the Houston Astros cheating scandal. And I just want to go back to what John Henry said about Cora and his involvement and the decision to part ways with him back in January when this first came out.
We've all held this wonderful baseball club to a very high standard. Today, this week, is not any different. We must ensure to the best of our ability that everyone in the organization represents the club in a manner that deserves the support and respect of our fans.
So I just found that really interesting. I watched the press conference today, and there were multiple questions to Cora about his role in Houston, and he wouldn't quite say whether he knew what he was doing at the time was wrong, but I thought one of the most telling answers was when someone asked him, basically, if this was so successful in Houston in 2017, they went on to win the World Series after this huge cheating scandal, and then he comes to Boston in 2018. They asked him why he decided not to bring that sort of scheme to Boston, and I thought his answer was pretty telling. Here's how Cora answered that.
I don't know, man. I just... decided, you know, in that off season to, I don't know, not bring it here. We had some conversations actually in spring training about a lot of stuff. I think at that point people were starting to talk about what was going on around the league, and you know, it wasn't worth it.
So that is so interesting, Chris. You and I have talked on air a couple times recently about sort of this battle for the soul of baseball. Where does this put that fight for the Sox?
I would say in the gray area. I mean, it sounds there like Cora saying they actually thought about trying to institute this scheme in Boston and decided not to because they felt like maybe they would get caught if they did. Cora walked this fine line. Look, he's loved by players. He's loved by Red Sox ownership. We've known that all along. So he was kind of walking this line today of trying to show that he was sorry, that he has repented and he's thought a lot about what he did and why it was wrong and all that. But no direct acknowledgement of, I knew at the time this was wrong. And if you remember the details of this Astros cheating scandal, it was so blatant. They're literally banging on trash cans to communicate with players on the field. almost spitting in the face of the integrity of baseball. I know sign stealing is a thing that goes on in the game, but they were basically analyzing live video and then communicating that via code to the players while the game's going on in front of stadiums full of people. Pretty disrespectful to the game, I think, and I have a hard time reconciling that. I like Alex Cora as a guy, as a manager. He has got a great approach. He balances the analytics and the eye test that we've talked about in the past. So it's really hard to kind of wrap your mind around this, and I know it's going to be hard to root for a guy. He says he's going to continue to try to make good on his actions over the last couple of years. We'll see kind of how that pans out as we move forward.
All right. So in our remaining time, I do want to switch gears to football. Got to ask you about the Pats. They barely beat the New York Jets last night, which, you know, the Jets would have been their first win of the season had they beat the Pats. So, it kind of feels like the bubble has been burst on the Pats dynasty here.
So I'm not quite there. I know everybody is going doom and gloom on the Pats. I think even if they have a terrible year and they finish something like 6-10 or some terrible record, they miss the playoffs, you have to kind of give a year to rebuild and see if Bill Belichick can build that back up. It's obviously the end of an era, right? Tom Brady is gone. The 20 years of Patriots winning that we saw since 2001, it's basically we've turned the page on that. The question is, can Bill Belichick build a winning team back? I think it'll be interesting to see. Cam Newton played pretty well in the game last night. Their offense is not as electric as they'd hope, but he's talked about some of the hard things they've gone through, and he says that they're basically trying to use these learning moments to get better as a team. Here's what he said after the game last night.
Well, the last couple of games, it kind of builds character. And, you know, we did a great job with situational football, trailing at halftime, but just being resilient and, you know, just battling back as an offense.
So they're 3-5. They're in third place in the division. They got a lot of ground to make up, but there's a lot of football left to be played. I'm not writing them off quite yet.
Okay, and in 30 seconds, Chris, give us the rundown on what's happening with college football where they didn't do a coronavirus bubble.
Yeah, and there was a big debate about whether or not they would or wouldn't try to play the season, and I think it kind of culminated in a moment that a lot of folks saw on Saturday. Notre Dame beat number one Clemson down in overtime, and students stormed the field, and it was a pretty jarring sight to see thousands of students jumping around, bumping into each other at a time where we know the pandemic numbers are rising and cases are surging. It'll be tough, I think, for college football to finish out the season. They're going to have a lot of challenges. And it's important to remember, these are student athletes. These are not professional athletes that get paid. So I think that adds an element to this as well.
Well, we're going to continue to check the score on all of it in future days. That's Radio Boston's Chris Siderick. Thanks, Chris.
Tommy point for you, Tiziana.
Tommy point. So Chris reminding us there again of the loss of a Celtics legend. And we're going to talk about another legend today too. Alex Trebek, who hosted the game show Jeopardy for a record-setting 37 years. Trebek died over the weekend after battling pancreatic cancer for a little more than a year and a half. He was 80 years old. Yesterday, Jeopardy executive producer Mike Richards opened the show with a tribute to Trebek.
This is an enormous loss for our staff and crew, for his family, and for his millions of fans. He loved this show and everything it stood for. In fact, he taped his final episodes less than 2 weeks ago. We will air his final 35 episodes as they were shot. That's what he wanted.
You know, last spring during the lockdown, my husband, daughter, and I made a ritual out of the evening Jeopardy viewing, and we're following his health and worrying about him. And so many families over the decades have tuned in faithfully to play along. So we want to remember Alex Trebek. We have Lily Chin, who was a PhD candidate at MIT and was the winner of the 2017 Jeopardy College Championship. Lily, thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So when did you hear the news that he had passed away, Lily, and how did you react?
So I actually got a text from my godfather who was saying, like, hey, I bet you've already heard this, but here it is. And then sort of my friends showed me the official Jeopardy tweet. And then I kind of immediately logged on to the Jeopardy contestants Facebook group where we kind of all connect. And it was just a lot just to see how everybody was handling this. Yeah.
And tell me about when you met him.
Yeah, I don't think most people know this, but for sort of the sanctity of the game show, they try to keep the people who know the questions and the people who are going to be answering the questions separate. So I only got a very sort of brief time to get to know Alex. But even then, right, like I found out he really likes home repair and his favorite movie is How Green Is My Valley and his favorite animal is the muskox, right? It's all these little details that you don't get to see on TV, but it really kind of lets you know that, you know, Alex really enjoyed being on the job, but also enjoyed sort of being like an uncle to the contestants as well as sort of America at large.
Let's listen for just a second to a bit of him hosting on the show. This is during a moment you're probably familiar with.
Astronomer who began his epitaph, "I used to measure the heavens. Now I shall measure the shadows of Earth." We come to Lily Chin. She had 20,400 going into final today. And her response, "Who is the spiciest meme lord?" All right, let's see what your wager was. Nothing. So 20,400 today, 20,400 yesterday gives you a total of 40,800. We bump that up to 100,000. You're the champion.
The first spiciest meme lord is just brilliant, and I have to tip my hat to you for that. But he must have on stage created the kind of environment where you could play and also participate. Tell us a little bit about that personality.
Yeah, I think it just is really sort of a testament to how professional he is, right? Like, obviously, he was in his 70s then and is not really aware of the internet culture of what this moment means. But, you know, he has the script in front of him and he really just wants to perform well and perform professionally. And so I really admire that. And yeah, it's just wild to me to see sort of the pictures that I have of my time on the set. And he's having as great of a time as all of us are having. And that's really something special.
It was remarkable the way he was open about his illness and his process going through it. And a lot of people rallied around him. How did the Jeopardy family do that?
Yeah, so one thing that I was really fortunate of was I was an alternate for the 2019 All-Stars tournament. So this means I got to meet some of the other Jeopardy celebrities like Ken Jennings and Brad Rutter. But I was sitting on the sidelines. And that when we heard about his diagnosis, so all of these people sort of put together this scrapbook and some of the folks were able to deliver this in person on his last filming last year. And it felt really special to be able to do something, to be part of something. And I know that the Jeopardy contestant community just poured out in mass as well as many of the fans. And I think that's really a testament to sort of what a public figure he was, that everybody wanted to sort of make sure that he was doing okay and send his regards.
And just very briefly, Lily, what do you want people to remember about him?
I think that the reason why everybody is sort of mourning Alex Trebek right now is because he really was a figure of sort of stability. Definitely during the beginning of the pandemic, I tuned into Jeopardy, and having that every night at 7:30 was really important to me. And I think everyone has this story, especially since it's spanning almost a generation of 37 years, right? So, Yeah, I think everybody will have their own memory of him, and it's special.
Well, Lily Chin, the 2017 Jeopardy College Championship winner, also a PhD candidate at MIT, thanks for helping us remember Alex Trebek today.
Thank you for having me.